7, okay.
This final site layout design, we're going to start off with Albie with MHA Works. You're on top.
Thank you very much. So a couple of these slides y'all have seen, but Danielle Hoff's got a presentation here. We're also going to ask our consultant, Scott Anderson, with Art, to talk through the final site design for everyone. So if you would, Danny, just kind of take it away and get to
So the first couple of slides are going to talk about the site, and then we're going to move into the building elevations and then some cost and schedule stuff. Scott, would you like to talk to the site first?
Sure.
Okay. Probably turn it on, maybe a switch on it.
Good to see you again. Again, my name is Scott Anderson. I'm with Art Consulting Group, civil engineer. This slide you've seen before. This is the topography of the site. This is the revised site layout that we have taken from our feedback that we got from you at the last meeting, and we have made several tweaks to it. We slid the building closer to Highway 17 as requested. And we also slid it just a little bit closer to Lancaster to kind of keep it centered in the site. This allowed us to keep the buffer at the back where we had it, but also allows for some future overflow parking, grass parking in that area. We also were able to take the stormwater pond that we had shown in the middle of the little drive-through lane adjacent to Lancaster, and we consolidate it, and now we just have one stormwater pond at the rear and to the west side of the site. We've done some additional geotech testing since we met last time, and unfortunately the water table is at or near the surface on this site, so we don't think that a dry pond is a feasible option here. I just don't think that it will stay dry even if we try to make it dry. So our intent now is to make it a stormwater wetland. So it will be planted. It'll require a little bit of maintenance to make sure we keep cattails and some other invasive species out. But that's not an uncommon practice.
Will it have to be fenced?
We recommend that it'll be fenced. The water in it's not deep. The way that the wetland works is you have really three different zones. You have a shallow, you have your deep pools, where you have a couple of deep pockets that are primarily at the where the water comes in and where the water goes out. You also have kind of a shallow water area, and that water is 9 to 12 inches deep. And then you've got a shallow land area that only gets wet immediately after a rainfall. So 2 to 5 days after a rain, it'll be 6 to 12 inches deep, and then it's gone from there. So it's not like a big wet pond where you've got 4 to 8 feet of water all the time in it. So it's a little bit safer from that standpoint.
Question, we have a history of unlikely water events.
Correct.
In this county.
Correct.
So what's the potential of overflow, significant overflow with this?
So it's designed to handle a 25-year storm, which we know that 500-year storms seem to happen every 10 or 15 years. But it will have an emergency spillway designed so that anything above a 25-year storm will release at a non-erosive velocity. So the spillway is designed to handle up to a 100-year storm at a non-erosive velocity.
Okay, you say a non-erosive velocity, that means that it will not overflow its banks?
No, it means when it overflows, it'll overflow in a wide enough path that it's non-erosive. So it's not going to wash the whole, it won't blow out the whole pond and then you have a massive failure.
Okay, because when I look at it, relatively still close to the parking area and things like that, just want to be sure that this is not something, not every 15 years, but if you're talking even 25 years, we get those all the time.
Yes. The good thing is your parking still and your building are both way above what the pond is. So this is probably important to go back to as a slide. This is the highest point right here.
Yep.
And it tapers off this way. So effectively, this portion right here is the lowest portion on the site already. So there's a foot of elevation for every one of those lines.
Correct.
So as you're thinking about where that is and what the bank elevation is, basically, if it overflows, this half the site that you're not purchasing is lower than all of your site. So that's be mindful of that too as you think about it.
Okay.
It will, like I said, it'll build up. It could spill over the banks, but it'll be no more than the water running off the parking lot will be generating off that site. So we don't have to click or plug in there. So you know, kind of do. The other thing that we changed on the site is we moved the dumpster to the rear of the site, to the back corner closest to the pond, and gave kind of common access to the dumpster and to the storage shed. I think that kind of got the dumpster away from the main entrance, main driveway, makes a little bit closer walking distance to the kitchen and where the building facilities will be using that. So plus it also helps a little bit to screen if that trash enclosure in the building did end up being situated there. Then you basically, that's part of what you're using to sort of screen the stormwater facility a little bit. So if you ended up fencing it, there's no reason you couldn't run the fence right up to that edge of it and basically cut out some of the fence. So from a site standpoint, are there any other, before we kind of move into talking about other aspects, parts of the site that the board is uncomfortable with or questions you have specific to that? Because one of the things on our docket today is make sure if everything's okay, we're actually going to request that we have approval so that we can make the submission of the entire package. We have the manager's signatures on those, but we need probably board approval to be able to do that.
Okay.
So barring any questions of that nature, we'll kind of keep going, but feel free to come back to it if you need to. One of the things that we really wanted to now that we're much more into the weeds of all of the building materials, Danny and I have looked at a lot of different parts of the cost estimate that we've got, and we have copies of that in a little more detail than this for all of you all. But we are showing something that's within budget. It's so close within budget that we'd like to have it a little lower than that so that we can have some alternates that give us a little bit more breathing room. Right now, when we say alternates, those are alternates that are in excess of that 99%. So one of the things that we need to look at is we do feel like the folding partition could be moved into the base, be an alternate that's accepted based on where our costs are falling right now. That would get you up close to that 100%. We do have a contingency of 3% that we're not touching at all that's basically built in to what we're doing. So when we show you these numbers, we basically have that amount of contingency. That's what we like to have as a minimum for a new building renovation. Minimum construction contingency is 5%. Those are what we typically aim for, and that's what we have accounted for presently. There is a reading loft that could easily come out of a furnishings budget, but it's a nice amenity that we can show you in the model and walk you through. But it's something that a casework manufacturer could build just like the rest of the casework. So we feel like that's a pretty easy item to think about doing as dollars permit. The storage facility, we have that. It's sort of a clean scope of work. If the costs come back high for that, that's not something that you couldn't basically place in that location at a much different cost. So we'll have that in the design so that you receive a price for it, but it's not in that base cost, if you will. And then the kitchen equipment. There's a lot of kitchen equipment that is on hand. It's not new. The kitchen equipment for that kitchen is a fairly expensive line item. We've got that spelled out. We believe if you bought all new sort of commercial grade equipment for that kitchen, it's liable to be $70,000-$75,000 installed, all brand new. So those are things that some of them are
plumbed and hardwired, some are not. Some are just stainless steel tables, things on casters, things that can be out of a furniture package. So our intent is for alternate number 4. We will have all of those things in the specifications and we'll receive a price for that, but we do not know if that number is going to come in because it's such a big chunk within your budget the way we're planning right now.
So what portion of that kitchen equipment is in fact in the budget?
So the things that are included are all the things that basically receive basically any of the counters, all the things that are basically receiving equipment that's countertop mounted, those things are in the base budget. All of the bulkheads, all of the power, all the plumbing to the connection point, all of that is in. So like if you have a refrigerator in your house that has an ice maker, it has a water line to it, and it has power to it, that's available. But the actual cost of something that you can get from a vendor and basically
you're basically talking about all appliances are not included.
No appliances.
Yeah. So that has the potential to be a big line item, but in speaking with the folks from the library, they were basically saying for their part of the furnishings and equipment, they have a separate grant that they're going to use to apply to that line item. So in terms of how we think about different pockets of money, those are the alternates right now that we feel like we have to identify some. If there are others that we can't identify, to give us a little bit more breathing room, we'd like to work through that with sort of a smaller group of folks. But we don't see any major cause for alarm relative to anything budgetary right now. We're basically accommodating about $600,000 worth of the total construction budget for site work. And relative to the size of the site, I believe we just did a dental clinic in Greenville that had about $300,000 associated with the site, about half the size. So it's, in terms of the parking, in terms of all the amenities you have, they do somewhat scale.
Listen, I just want to make sure I understood what you said. The library said they do have separate funding for kitchen.
Yes, they have.
No, not for the kitchen.
Not kitchen. The equipment.
For the library equipment.
Not kitchen stuff.
Yeah, they've committed $400,000 for the library.
But not kitchen equipment.
Correct, just the library's.
Billy, what would be the impact of that on you guys not having the appliance stuff? I mean,
it has to be approved. That's about all you'd have. We wouldn't have, we don't have different kind of equipment put back in there like that.
Billy, is that something that North Carolina State may would help us with?
No. Okay. You got another grant somewhere. That's what I was thinking about.
The bids could come in good, and we're going to have it as an alternate, so we receive a price. But it's a significant line item, and so it's something that a vendor can come in. If it's a refrigerator, yes, having that exact model of refrigerator might be important to the way you want it to sort of really function. But another refrigerator might work. So I think what we're trying to do is look at this estimate and make sure that all of the infrastructure that you need to make it function the way you want is accommodated.
Billy, Steve Mazzell's place over in Eaton would be beneficial to go look at.
Yeah, I was thinking about him. His restaurant style equipment, that might be possible.
Well, there are a couple other options that we might recommend as well. We are doing a new equipment shop for Division 2 of the DOT in Greenville, and we went down to Castle Haney to see a similar facility, and they had their entire machine shop and welding shop furnished from basically surplus equipment from community college programs, and all of it was better than any other equipment shop that the DOT has in the state, and it was all from that source, and they basically had folks that looked at it, evaluated it, and figured out what to put in, and that's what they accommodated. So there are a lot of resources of that nature available. It's just a matter of
they're a lot cheaper also.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
exactly. So okay.
There are some owner items. So if there are special security systems, so we have the hardware accommodated, but if there's a special security system that this building would ultimately need to integrate to on a broader system, that's not in. We just want to walk through some of those things that are not included in our estimate. The furniture for the library is presently not in our construction cost. Likewise with the other furniture for the other spaces, and that's a pretty significant line item. Danielle just passed out the more detailed breakdown, and I think the last page of that shows what we think some of those lines might start to look like. So if that's brand new furniture based on our other jobs, those are what some of those costs could come in at. So if you've got a $400,000 line item that the library is coming to the table with, how far might that go? We're trying to at least think about some of those things. Technology and equipment, any kind of projection screens that are mounted into the ceiling, the projectors themselves, flat screen TVs in certain locations, those things are not part of what we're estimating yet. The data cabling and equipment, so we have the conduit, the routing in what we have, but if you have a specific vendor that does all your work for the county and you want that particular vendor on the job, and you have a certain, maybe the different user groups in the building won't have separate servers, so we haven't had that level of discussion yet in terms of each user group, so that's something that we would need to accommodate separately. And then anything from land, when we say landscaping is beyond the minimums, effectively what that's trying to get to is there was a lot of interest on the library side to have a community garden or something of that vein. So all of the $600,000 that we have earmarked for the site should accommodate the stormwater, the planting associated with the stormwater facilities, all of the other site amenities that are required by zoning to meet what will get permitted, but anything in excess of that would basically be something that could be wide open, and that's the reason on your sheet that's actually left blank. That can be a community initiative, it could be all handled all kinds of ways, but you will not have a barren site by any means. It's just if you want it to have a beautiful community garden with pavers and those kinds of things that have nameplates for donors, those things are basically not accommodated in what we have budgeted for.
So these items here are not included in the budget. But however, as we work it, it could possibly some could be put in.
The estimate that you have there before you basically has about $45,000 unaccounted for, and we believe that that one or two of the alternates are probably going to be close to that number. Mm-hmm. So if we get good competitive bids, we believe that you might, at this time, based on what we think the costs are going to come in, we believe you might be able to pick up an alternate, maybe two, but you're not going to get all of those alternates with the monies that you have right now. I think that's very unlikely.
In our conversation we had, and again, when this thing gets bid out, as it comes under bid, that money can be used, okay? And it has to be used,
right.
Correct?
That's correct. And
say, for example, if this thing comes in and it bids in at $300,000 to $400,000 under what we think, okay? That's 10%, okay? Then that money can be turned back into office furniture, things of that nature, correct?
So the first...
They have to run that by Golden Leaf.
Okay.
On the furniture, they were pretty specific about not funding the furniture. That's why they were so interested in the library participation.
Uh-huh.
And with the money they have, we might be able to pick up not only the reading loft, but potentially the lion's share of that folding partition. So
right.
I think you've got some flexibility there. And we'll have bids by May,
May.
We think.
Probably. Yeah.
And that'll be right on the cusp of your budget for next year. So we'll be able to look at some options there as well.
I think I also asked the question before, I mean, no computers, nothing like that can be used for that money either.
So very well said, Scott. So I think that that's exactly how we started to try to think of these alternates. Like what things could you legitimately call furniture if you needed to call furniture and fixtures? But if the bids come in good, for instance, the folding partition, that's half one way and half the other. So that Golden Leaf would fund in full if your money allows for it. The reading loft, we could easily make the case we're going to have a design for that in the package. So if your numbers come in good, that's funded out of the Golden Leaf fund.
The storage shed would probably be the same thing. That's built infrastructure. So I would say that, that's maybe a conversation, but that's not like furniture. It's not separate. Whereas the kitchen equipment, I think they would also fund that, because that's sort of all of the things below where it says owner costs, those are the things, and that's sort of the distinction between the two line items. Those are typically not things that they would furnish. The data cabling may be being one of the only exceptions to that list. So that I hope that the information we're providing at the back of the cost estimate sheet helps in that regard. And if you have questions about which things are in the cost estimate, the rest of what's there should help.
Give me your definition of data cabling.
Data cabling, so if you have like a Cat 6E cable that basically goes from your server rack directly into to the jack on the wall throughout the building. Mm-hmm. A lot of the clients that we work with have specific proprietary vendors that they like making the terminations. Mm-hmm. So they might provide the server rack, but then themselves as a client, but they also want to control who makes those terminations from a data standpoint. So a lot of clients prefer that cabling package to be separate. The jack's cover plate would be in, mm-hmm. in the contract, but terminating to that and all of the cable from that point back to the server room would not be.
That's something we're going to sit down and have a long conversation about with Joe and Scott.
Right, I think our IT staff.
Because once walls go up, we're dead fish in the water. We need to be able to make sure we've got everything in line at that point in some stage.
So what we want to do, and I think we already have a pretty good handle on that from the users, but what we would have is we would have empty conduit with pull strings to all those locations. So it's not a hard piece of work. You basically tie whatever cable you're doing and you pull it on the pull string.
Yeah.
But a lot of owners like to have more control rather than less over that aspect of the work.
Sometimes we have the owner does part of it and the contractor does part of it, and then if something doesn't work exactly right, everyone's pointing fingers and
right.
It can get really messy.
Well, that's, yeah.
Better sometimes just have everything dealing with the cabling and data to be done by one entity.
Tell me a little bit more about that 3% set aside. That's the use of that is not included in here, right?
That's a thank you. That was the other point that I wanted to come back to. So, back to Commissioner Trent's point, that's money that's allocated to the job for construction. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to spend that on day one. That basically is making sure that halfway through the project, if something unexpected comes up, that you don't have to.
Clearly understand, but if nothing unexpected comes under, then that $100,000 would be still available to us, right?
That's true. That 3% represents sort of a rough average for new construction is what that is intended to represent. So if you get to the last 3 months of the job and you're like, wow, we hadn't burned through any of this at all and you've got a bunch left, that's when you would electively add things back into the job that you would otherwise defer on. So it could be that you basically add the folding partition in at the end of the job and accept that alternate or something like that.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
This is from Billy. Will you be needing commercial kitchen equipment?
The input we have from our staff mm-hmm. was yes. Like stuff we had earlier in the old building, you know,
residential.
It was functional, but it didn't meet the need to be like a so they were trying to get it up to, you know, where they might need to be. There's a big group, so we'll just, you know, kind of get up to where it stands a little bit. Yeah, they were pretty aggressive, I guess, in trying to plan for this and trying to get something, not a huge kitchen, but some other kind of thing. But other than like, they didn't want a home refrigerator, and it felt like they
sure,
had like,
sure.
a commercial refrigerator.
Have you ever looked into, Billy, like, you know, the state of North Carolina surplus, like they have furniture, they have kitchen equipment, they have all kind of commercial grade stuff too, right?
Yeah, that's how we got our office furnished now.
Yeah, well, we did too. A lot of the counties, same yeah, way. So that may be a great option. They have stuff in there that's like pretty cool.
But you kind of have to mercy of whenever somebody else decides to vacate it, most great. So they may have it there, they may not.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. A lot of times if we look into it and you find there's something there, maybe we can hold something or whatever. We've got a little inside track into that. into those folks over here through through the commissioner here.
and we are accommodating all of the code aspects for a commercial kitchen. So everything that you ask for in terms of how that needs to be separated, sure, and all of the power, all of those things are accommodated. It's just what ends up happening is that that kitchen equipment is a pretty big line item right by itself that could easily come out of a furnishings budget if there were one associated with that somewhere else. That's the reason we wanted to talk about it. But,
okay, because I was thinking if we ever decide to start off residential and move up, there is a place that sell brand new appliances. You may have a little scratch, but you can't hardly tell it.
Scratch
for like $100. So we get it started. That's in Greenwood.
So what we're going to do, we wanted to share this because this is a little bit more detailed information than previous meetings as a precursor to talking about the materials. Because basically now we have enough takeoff that we're actually assigning square footages and linear feet, specific material costs to different items within the project. So if you will, Daniel, let's kind of walk through some of the other things.
So this you've seen this slide before. It's just a reiteration of the floor plan. This hasn't changed since last time you saw it, but we wanted to put it up in front of you again just so you could take a look at it one more time.
The three areas of the building, if you consider the yellow area and the white area sort of common space, it roughly breaks down into equal thirds. So if you think about that relative to the furnishings cost on the last page, that's what that equates to. So if you're like, which one is in which camp, it relates to that graphic.
And so here, some exterior renderings that kind of take what we've shown you before and refined it based on your previous feedback. So here, this is the view that you can see from NC17. And we're looking at the long side of the building. So you're looking into the library, and then farther down, you're looking into the community room. What we're showing right now is the blue. The blue-gray is like a metal panel, a standing seam metal panel. And then we actually brought some material samples so you guys can touch it and feel it and kind of see it in real life and kind of get an idea of what we're talking about. And then the roof is the gray. And it's a metallic gray, so it looks kind of dark inside, but if you hold it up to the light, like a roof would be a bagel, when the sun is shining on it, and even when the sun is like the side of it, it'll be very reflective, and so it'll be a cool roof, which is great for energy use, but it'll also feel light on the building. And then the red, we're showing as a brick or masonry, and then we brought a couple panels of that too. There's about as many options for brick as there is for paint colors on your walls. So this is just one example of what we can pick. But there are many, many, many bricks. And if you want to go with the red brick, as we're showing now, even within the reds, there's, you know, the sky's the limit for what kind of red we pick.
Just to clarify, I seem to recall we're going to move away from the porthole look where those windows are on the two gray panels to maximize your shelf space, or am I remembering that?
That was at this end.
I'm writing.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're still going to maintain them on the
other end.
Okay. I think the only reason we left, we did actually show a rendering where they weren't on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Our cost estimate includes the amount of glass that we're showing here, but part of the reason that we're showing them there is because that portion is under the mezzanine and it's going to be a little darker. That's higher than the shelving.
That's
so,
a good point.
So it actually will kind of help that not feel so dead end down there.
I think it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, from the up here, but this here is a different color, which is also.
That's what you see from the road. That's what you see from the road. You see that.
Yeah.
And then we thought taking away the windows on the Lancaster Avenue side of the building, it'd be a great opportunity to put some really big signage on the building. Yeah. Which might eliminate the need to have a sign at the brook, and that could be a really nice feature for help make that wall feel intentional and give it a place.
Just so I'm clear, you're going to have guttering going across the front.
Yep.
Anywhere we've got the pitch coming down, where the doorways are at, be guttered.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. And it'll all be piped. And
underneath.
Yep.
And going out.
Yep.
Okay.
Nothing will be sheet flow.
Yeah. I know we discussed it last time. I just want to make sure. Okay.
Another thing that we're showing, all the glass that you see is storefront, and that is an important, it's kind of technical, but it's an important cost-saving thing that we're considering. All the glass doesn't go any higher than 12 feet, and then by doing that, we are able to use a more economical product. If we went above 12 feet, then we would have to use curtain wall instead, which is a lot more costly. So we're really aware of everywhere we have the glass that we're being really conscious to make sure that we're being as economical as we can with those choices.
So for instance, over here on this side of the building where we really wanted to have the glass up high, we basically have a beam here that allows that to be in a 12-foot section, and that's been more than 12 feet, which is sort of a maximum span for that glass system type. So it's about almost triple the cost to go to the other system. So that's a nice cost-saving measure.
How was that roof fastened down?
That's a great question. So you want to kind of...
Sure.
So the cost estimate right now, this is actually a Douglas fir, but we do have a wood deck costed right now. We feel like that'll give a lot of warmth to the space. You kind of see a little bit of that on the underside right there. We're showing it where you can, the way this is actually going to run is the decking would not run this way because it's a long way to span from here to the next truss. It actually is going to span vertically this way. There would be purlins similar to a metal building running this way, but they would be close enough together that this doesn't have to get so thick. So that's going to give you a really nice clean look with your tongue and groove wood, and that would basically go from this point all the way through this portion of the building to where this ends.
That's
and then
fantastic.
From here over, you actually have ceiling, so you wouldn't actually see it, so you don't get the benefit of it. So about half the building area is conventional metal deck fastened to your roof structure, and about half of it is a wood deck basically fastened to your purlins.
Okay.
So it's about 50-50.
And then that will be stained. Okay.
So the roof itself, maybe you answered the question I didn't understand. How is the roof fastened back? The roof, I guess the metal is tucked in.
Okay, so it's a standing, I'm sorry. So it's a standing seam metal roof system similar to your high schools. It comes with a good warranty. It's Kynar finish. They basically have it's a rigid insulation system that basically sits on the top side of either this or your metal deck. Those are the two systems you have. And then what happens is that roofing is basically fastened down through the insulation back into the decking. So, and then the decking is what's fastened to the rest of the structure of the building. So that's how that would work.
Then the fasteners.
There's a fastener that basically attaches your metal roof system down back to the rest of the building substrate. If you want to, that's a much finer level of detail, but we'll be happy to walk you through the specific details for those products. And there's
I'm no architect. I was just looking at how flat the roof is at the top part of it.
It's actually got ribs.
Can you go to a couple of the other views? So it's the. Do you know what the roof pitch is, by chance?
312.
Is the flattest section?
They flat roof, and this is over here, but there's a slope like a 112 pitch.
No, the flattest section of metal.
It's 312.
Yeah. So, that's the.
What we discussed at the flat roof is going to be pitched also.
That's
not going to see it being pitched because it's.
Great point. So, relative to worrying about uplift or water control, if you have a roof that is flatter than 312, it's not a good candidate for a shingle roof like on your house because they typically don't warrant it because the water wants to blow back up underneath it. Whereas a metal roof, you can warrant all the way down to about a 1-in-12. The cheapest metal buildings that you see are about a 1-in-12 metal
pitch.
Roof. So, and once you get flatter than that, you're typically a flat roof and it's either an EPDM or a TPO or
on the reverse side where the cooperative extension is, I think what Commissioner Atkins was also asking, with that being a flat roof, I was explaining to him we're pitching that also, probably about a 112 going towards the outside, correct?
So that's
what we discussed anyhow.
Do you have the view all the way around on the far end? So yes. So what happens is this entire roof section here on the opposite side, basically it's going to pitch back to this outside wall. And then there'll be a roof cricket that basically allows that to come to this conductor box and drain down into the swarm system. Same thing happened here. So
So basically draining here, there's a little bit of a hydrant right here with the cricket that comes back to that.
Yeah. You just don't see it.
You can't see it. It's got a turf.
And that's important because there's going to be a lot of equipment on the roof back there, so we don't want to necessarily let folks have that view of all of that's what we're trying to represent there.
Yeah. So that's the parapet, so that you don't see the actual roof membrane on the flat roof. The membrane is like a rubber, it's a TPO. Rubber PVC type material, and it's usually fastened and adhered to the roof, and then it runs up the parapet and over
Laps.
The cap, and it's all flashed in together. And this warrants also Miami-Dade type conditions.
So here it's shown as dead flat. It would not actually be dead flat. It would slope down to that side. The other thing that we have seen this view, since we're talking about roof, so the other thing that we've done here to simplify this, because these units are going to be the way our mechanical engineer, now that we actually have a mechanical design to work from, we know about where he wants to situate them and about how tall they would be on the curve. So the other thing that we're looking at is this would actually be a parapet. Previously, we had this volume coming up even higher. But what we've done now is actually leave the parapet high, but let the roof be low so that your sight line to the equipment on the roof is concealing that as much as possible. And what that also has allowed us to do is simplify the roof. This is one roof system all the way up to here.
Let me ask you a question, Albie. I see where you get your parapet, but how about going back across in front of the equipment? Is that a parapet wall there, or is that just a step off?
That is actually
right here.
That's
right,
going to be a strip. This piece right here, that is not a step. That's going to be, if you have a sight line where you get back in here,
okay,
and you see that, we want to have a screen wall system that's ballasted.
All right, how are we going to channel that water from back there? Okay.
It's not blocking. I would like to bring you some cut sheets.
Okay.
That is actually a ballasted system that doesn't touch the roof membrane.
Okay.
It sits above it. What happens is your sight line is going to be broken by it.
Okay.
Water is still going to pass through that along the roof all the way to the other side.
Okay, I'm just making sure it's not solid. I know
the
Bertie Martin Correctional Facility, right, they've got all the units surrounded by parapet walls on top of the roof and then a parapet wall around the roof, and it traps the water in there. So I'm just making sure.
This is basically City Hall in Greenville has a system.
Okay.
Like this. They have a flat roof, and you would see all the mechanical equipment, and they basically have
it. Just goes underneath. System. That'd be fine.
And then the ones that you see in the middle here, mm-hmm, are so tightly in the middle that you have to get like in an airplane or helicopter to see it. So you won't really see it from
Now, where you've got cooperative extension in the windows here, we've got wood there. Or is that a masonry product?
We were thinking that this would be like a wood that would be similar to this. It wouldn't be a wood deck. It would just, mm-hmm, be like a siding material.
Right.
But we were thinking it would be similar, like a tummy roof type of system.
Not a hardy plank or anything like that, but it would be a wood system, correct?
We like the warmth of it. We need to explore the exact material for that more. But right now we have it costed as like a wood siding.
Okay.
That's a concern. They do sell some really good manufactured products,
mm-hmm,
that are cementitious based or PVC based.
Well, they're very much water resistant.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking at.
But for what we have costed right now, we feel like we have some options.
Okay.
And this acts more as like a screen anyway. We still have a really, really robust water barrier. It's going to be behind, mm-hmm, the whole wall system. So,
mm-hmm,
it's not going to be tight bar. It'll be a really good water membrane system, mm-hmm, behind.
Is that type of wood maintenance free almost?
The only thing that you have to be conscious of here is carpenter bees. You can get it impregnated, but you have to be mindful of those because those and the wasps,
they're
dobbers.
That's,
you got to do some maintenance just to keep those out of
there. That's one reason the hardy plank lapped.
Yeah, the engineered stuff, water resistant. In addition, looks almost like wood.
Yep.
Nowadays, they make it so pretty you can't.
It
really
is a little
tell.
More expensive.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
So that's kind of where we're weighing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I agree. We have to look at the whole life cycle.
So if you will just kind of flip through a couple of views.
Sure. Kind of go back in order. So this was on this is on NC-17, and then this is the entrance closer to NC-17 from Lancaster Avenue. So
There is one for this meeting, I'm sorry. There is one change that Scott and I discussed on the site civil, and it's not reflecting on that civil sheet yet. But what we really want to do is, can you go back to the site plan view of that? That might be easier to see there. So right here, because we moved this further to the front, that makes this sort of a much tighter distance. And so we really don't want to get too close there. So one of the things that we're talking about is actually having this rain garden here, basically that wall pulled back so that this sidewalk comes all the way around, so that if you're unloading here or here, you basically are unloading directly onto the sidewalk as opposed to right into that little wall. So this will still be there. It'll just be on the back side of the sidewalk and curb and gutter as opposed to all the way at the street edge. So we haven't caught up to that in the rendering yet, but that's going to be a problem. We actually ran that sidewalk. So that'll be a nice improvement over what we're showing in terms of the rendering right now, where it feels like that little brick wall is right next to the asphalt.
One change that we've made since the last iteration, it kind of relates back to the discussion we had about how we simplified the roof. We cut out some of the overhang that was there, and also as a cost-saving measure, and we allowed that entry, the glass entryway, to kind of become a little more prominent. What this allowed was, first of all, cost saving, and second of all, it made the entrance a lot more prominent. And so when you're at in the parking lot or from the front or like pretty much wherever you are, you'll innately know where the entrance is because of the way the glass is tall and it's not really hiding anymore underneath the overhang. We still have a significant amount of overhang. You can probably fit two or three classrooms of kids underneath that overhang still. So we're not detracting from it. We're just making it a little more feasible for cost and to allow the building mass and the entryway to be more obvious.
And that faces what direction does that face?
North.
No, not directionally.
So this is, let's see, this is east in this direction. So looking back out towards Lancaster is almost due east from the building. And then this is basically north, so the south side of the back that way. Okay. So you're not exposing it to any glass as an entry point.
Right. And usability with sun and things like that under there, that's on the evening side.
And the overhang pretty much comes about two-thirds to three-quarters of the way over that glass. So when we do, and it's a really long overhang, so when we do get that lower sun, it'll probably be a problem, like every east-facing building with glass at the very, very, very early morning. But once the sun gets a little bit higher, it won't be an issue for us today. Yeah. And that's also why we have the clear story up high on the north side. So we'll get all that really nice natural light in the building, but there will be no direct sunlight in there. So it'll all be diffused. We're showing some overhangs on the top extension side on the masonry areas, so right here. That we imagine would be a color that would match the metal panel. So the metal panel on the library side will come back and it'll be, the color will be represented in the overhangs of those windows. And then like we discussed, we have some wood shown within the masonry. And I think we're trying to take the library side and the Clocker Extension side, and because the massing of them are pretty different, we have the slope roof in the library and we have the flat roof in the Clocker Extension, and we're trying to make all the materials kind of be like one thing, which can be challenging sometimes. So that's why we keep taking the same kind of elements and repeating them throughout the exterior of the building. An interesting part, which I think you've seen before, is we walk up to the front door, and we have a little piece of inset wood on the library side with some porthole windows, and this goes right into the kids section of the library. So those portholes are actual like nooks that kids can sit in and read their books while they're in there. They're big enough, if the parent wants to sit in there with them, they can, but it's intended for the kids. I think this is a kind of a fun way to introduce people to what's happening on the inside of the building when you're still on the outside. And it gives it the entryway a nice visual interest. And it's to kind of pan around the building, looking towards the community room side, this changed a little bit too from last time you saw it. Before we had the clear story that came about halfway further than you see now into the community room side. We pulled it back because as we were looking through, there's kind of multiple reasons why we did this. The main reason was because when we were looking at how we could put the partition in the community room and make it make sense, we realized that like the trusses go one way and the partition would kind of be perpendicular to it. And when you do that, it cuts the space in half. And we felt like it was, we're spending a ton of money on making this beautiful truss system with a beautiful wood deck, and then we were gonna cut it in half with a folding partition.
Right.
So when we started thinking about it pragmatically, it makes a lot more sense for us to simplify that structure and not spend our money there when we would have to cover it up most likely anyway for the folding partition. So we simplified the structure to a simple gable roof, and then the community room would have a ceiling. It'll be tall still, it'll be like 14 feet, but it'll have a ceiling system in it. So that way it can be acoustically separated very well, and the folding partition will have a home, and it'll make a lot more sense. And then if we kind of move forward a little bit from that, I think it also makes the massing of the building better. It makes it more simple. And it feels a lot more clean now too. So I think it was a win-win when we made that move.
The biggest thing was we really just didn't want to have expensive trusses, and then if we would have had trusses where we had to put the beam that holds the partition right below that, then you have to do something acoustically to separate one side from the other. So then how do you fill that in? And you got all the glass from the clear story. You would have had to put glass above the beam. It would have been a very expensive endeavor to do, which you would never really experience that way. So we felt like that money was best served with someone else.
The gain we would have had was, I think, small. Yeah.
Right. And there's going to be plenty of light in that space anyway, mm-hmm. So I'm not really worried about the scale of that space. But this is an entrance directly into that space from the exterior. This is an entry up through the main corridor of the building, and then on the NC-17 side, there are also means out because each one of the individual spaces is big enough to accommodate over 50 people. So we basically have two doors out, even when the spaces are separated from the inner space.
And then you see right here in the clear story, can you see where my pointer is? That is representative, it's going to be like a louver, as we have a lot of our mechanical equipment coming in and out of the building. So that's what that represents. And the finish of that will be, it'll match to the storefront finish. So it'll feel like it's one thing, but that's why it looks solid, because it'll be like kind of like a, see your louver blinds, it'll be like a finned louver right there. And we're also showing some additional signage on the corner here, because as you're we have a lot of signage on the front of the building, but we didn't really have anything on this side. So we thought it was a good opportunity to put some more signage on the building. So no matter where you are in the parking lot, you know where you're going.
Do you have a slide that actually shows the inside where I remember what the truss part looked like.
Sure.
But do you have something that shows that inside with the 14-foot ceiling too?
I don't know if we actually modeled that exactly. But I can take a look. I think it's still left open from before. So this is what it looked like when we didn't have a
right.
partition.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, yeah.
The ceiling will be pretty much right where the top of the glass is.
That's 14.
And it'll mm-hmm. it'll come all the way across.
Oh, okay. That's not bad.
The peak would be what, about 17, since it's 16, 17 feet, the peak up there?
Yeah, the peak's up a good ways, but we need some of that depth for mm-hmm. the, basically you want to keep your partition
right.
down lower. Mm-hmm. And so that way you use some of that structural depth for the beam that has to hold up the mm-hmm. partition that's mobile. But that's still a pretty good sized space.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
So this is, can you put the person, the eye level down at
the
first level?
It's going to be really good height for this ceiling.
All right, so.
Yeah, that's a pretty good with that. Maybe with the trusses and everything exposed, but this is just, I understand what you're saying.
So this is like a normal person's vantage point. So if you can imagine, you know, there's the doors are 7 feet tall. So it's still going to be a pretty good size space.
Mm-hmm.
We can, if you want to do that in a couple of the other spaces too, since this is the first time we brought the model, I mean, if it's beneficial at all.
So if you walk in this door right here, this is looking down that hallway. So it's still, the inside's a little rough still. I was prioritizing the exterior. But when we come back again, we can have a lot more detail on the interior. So things like this, this wall will be a solid wall.
But it gives you a rough idea for how big the volume will be, sort of how we're thinking about it being used. And you can see the silhouettes of the people, and the sort of the glass looking back out towards the front of the building.
So this is that reading circle that we had talked about before for the librarians, but it's also out in the main space, so it can be used by Quack Extension or the community at large whenever the librarians are using it. And we added a little bench on the opposite side here, this entrance right here, this corner, is where you go into the restrooms. So it can be like a waiting spot for the husbands that are waiting for their wives.
But it's always a line.
There is. Right. this is the, when we made this glass get taller, instead of it being under the slope roof, made it feel a lot airier. It flows to the outside a lot better. And it kind of flows right into where the library is. And we walk into the library. And this is that reading loft that we were talking about, which incorporates some seat stairs and some shelving, some stairs that go up to a little space for the kids to have bean bags or whatever, and have their little reading niche. And then here are those reading nooks that we talked about from the outside. This is where they are on the inside.
Show the trusses. I think that's also kind of interesting, sort of like looking at the truss height. So we've also worked hard with the structural engineer to really figure out where the truss is going to be located. We're not representing the purlins yet, per se, but we are representing the trusses pretty accurately to where they would actually fall. So we're starting to sort of think about that. We need to do a little bit more work there on the upper portion relative to the window and how that sort of interfaces with the truss location. But by and large, since the last time we met, we've spent a lot of time with our engineers really working through where all things were to be.
Here is the windows that we talked about on the outside. So you can see how this is the mezzanine area above us. And so the windows here are above the height of the shelving, and we'll just let some nice light dump into that kind of lower, darker area. Is the circulation desk. So you can see the stairs that go up to the mezzanine. You can only access from behind their desk. So it'll keep the public from going up there. It'll just be accessed by the librarians, library staff. Here we can get a view from the other side through the library space.
And we're not representing the ductwork in the space yet, so there will be, through these larger sections, there will be a spiral duct here running above the bottom height of this, but it'll basically run through that, and that's how you'll heat cool the space.
I don't like that, but I mean, is that 4-H in Columbia?
Yeah. That's actually not spiral duct. That's a sock duct there, so that's actually like a fabric. This will be a metal duct. A lot of restaurants have it, so it's a little bit dressier than that. It's sock duct, which is an apropos name. It's basically like a big sock that they're blowing air through. It's kind of interesting. But if this is sized appropriately, and we're basically sizing the duct a little bit larger than you need in a bare minimum, because that keeps the velocities of the air down. So the idea is that we want to have a little whistle in the system. Here you kind of, it's audible. So there's a fine line between bite noise and disturbing in the library. So we're talking to our engineer pretty hard about that.
Can we figure out the doors, especially that one over in the children's area, so children can't get out?
I think we've talked about how, you know, which doors would need to be sort of on an alarmed or a switched alarm type setting. So I think that's not too difficult to work through.
Can
Can we go back to the exterior entrance of the community room? The roof kind of hangs over. Is there a pillar holding the?
There would be. Yeah, we would have a column right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be similar to the way it's treated on the front.
Okay.
Where we have a column right here at the corner.
Right. And that also facilitates, we're not showing the gutters yet in all of them. We're showing them on the brick on some spots, but all of the gutters basically need something to come down, so it's nice to have them in the column to be able to scrap those.
I think the only thing we didn't talk about is, you can see all the way around the building where we have brick or wood or metal panel, we have this light material.
Mm-hmm.
And we were thinking it would be this polished block type material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a CMU, it's like a CMU material, but it's polished.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be a really nice, smooth, unifying mm-hmm. feature that'll bring you all the way around the building.
It looks like terrazzo.
Yeah, so it's going to be pretty next to that right there.
It's like a water table.
That's nice.
Water table. So any water that's comes down and hits the ground and splashes up, it'll hit that instead of your metal tank. So it makes the maintenance of the building easier.
Probably in a steady bag.
And it doesn't like mold and mildew that stains up.
So, a lot of times what people see on masonry that they really don't like is the efflorescence. It's basically when the materials inside the aggregates, typically for the mortar, basically react with water, and it basically kind of looks like white leaching down the face of the masonry. So to the extent that we can minimize water running down the face of the masonry, that will help. Also, the mortar, the mix in the mortar itself has a lot to do with being able to minimize that. It's almost impossible to control completely, but there are things you can do to minimize
it. Yeah, I often see so many buildings where they trim down the bottom. Somehow, over the short period of time, you see the little mold, mildew, and it starts to,
green.
Yeah, it starts green. Does that?
But this with the pressure wash out of it.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is a little bit like having a tile shower. The more grout lines you got, the more opportunity for that you have. So a lot of times the reason us and other designers like to have a bigger material lower to the ground is you minimize the opportunities for that. In terms of the massing or the colors, or is there anything that gives the board pause or the manager pause about any of the things that we're suggesting, directions we need to move away from?
Actually, I think you're pretty spot on.
Yeah, I love the colors.
I do too.
So we are moving ahead pretty quickly with all of our engineers. So if at some point, I think what we'd like to do is get to where we feel like we're 80-90%, rather than have another meeting where we're doing something similar to this again, I want to be able to have a discussion with the folks who are actually going to be charged with maintaining the systems and actually have our engineer here to walk through the building systems before he finalizes it, make sure they don't want modifications. I think that would be the most useful sort of next step from our team. Barring anything, if anything comes up from a budgetary standpoint that was unexpected on our end, we notify you all immediately. But for right now, I think the most useful information for us to keep this fairly quick timeline is going to be basically to shoot for that type of meeting.
One question on the heating and air, HVAC. You're not using chiller units, are you?
No, this is all, okay. This is all five-ton.
I just want to make sure you weren't using chiller units, that's all. Okay.
And it's not necessarily the most energy efficient way to do it, but it is by far the easiest way here to replace a system if something goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason we're doing it.
Yep.
One question about the back area behind the parking lot on the tree line again. What did we say it's going to be the barrier from the residential stuff? Is there some kind of barrier in the plan, or is that something that would be addition to the cost?
Yeah, so the ordinance requires that we put up a 6-foot-high fence and landscaping. So along the residential, we'll still have the existing woods that are there, but the ordinance requires that we have to plant or put a 6-foot fence 5 feet off the property line and put trees and shrubs on the residential side of that fence to screen it.
Okay, and that piece of land there, is that relatively flat? What is the slope of that? Or, because one of the things we talked about, not just for potential parking lot expansion, but we talked about the possibility of maybe doing something else there on the site at some time if we didn't need it.
Vincent. So, can you go back to the other view for a second? So, what you can see here is this is one of the accommodations that Scott mentioned earlier. So, this is the how many parking spaces is it? Just under 80. So 80 paved spaces.
Right.
There are also a couple of, the sprinter isn't showing it, but in the submission that we'll make, there are also a couple of the ADA spaces back here. So it's sort of a short walk to your community space. But this is another probably 40, 50, depends on, obviously if there's not a paved mark,
people tend to
park a little further apart, but it does give you about 50% more parking if it's used very intermittently. Now, the site, I walked it today. We were a little early, so I actually got out on the site and walked it a little bit. There's a fair amount of standing water, so if you're using it a lot and it's unimproved, it will be muddy in a hurry. Basically, all of you, if you look at this, is about 64 feet. So you basically have another 64 feet there again. So if you're worried about how close you are, it's not that close.
Right, and it's relatively. It's not like,
that's what, you know, that's what Danielle was showing. It's basically slopes about maybe 1 foot in 20 or 30 feet.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if we find out later down the line, a few years, and we don't really need the parking, that gives us some actual expansion of some other things.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
In your site work, can you include anything in that? Do any grading or
other? We'll clear it, and it'll be graded and grass, so it'll be smooth. So grass that can drain is going to be drier than woods, typically.
Yeah.
Now, will y'all do the fencing, or will we?
The fencing is in the 600 for the roughly $600,000. That's a requirement.
Around the pond, also.
The pond fencing will not be privacy fencing. That'll be a different kind of fencing.
I'm thinking it's a vinyl coated chain link as a base.
You've seen them that come in green color and stuff like that.
Green or black.
Some of these commercial places,
and it's just
especially truck stops.
It's not tall like privacy fence.
The McDonald's in Hartford has that privacy fence around their little pond there, and it's just really ugly.
Yeah. I mean, if the wetland is done right, if it's planted right, if it's maintained, it can be an attractive feature. If it's not maintained, then it'll grow up with cattails and it won't be as attractive. It's just the nature of it is.
At the back of your site now. I think we've done what we can to sort of mitigate that.
Exterior lighting. What is it?
So we got $12,000 in the estimate that you have for site lighting, which basically should cover about three site poles that would be lit. Now, sometimes the local utility furnishes those, but we basically have three parking lot lights that would basically be in the estimate, and those are the tall kind, like you have in a parking lot. That's in addition to whatever part of the lighting that we have directly on the building you're required to have. Minimal foot candles at the building level where you discharge, so that you also have. So that's what's in the budgeting right now. If there's something specifically that you want, then we can obviously accommodate that. We don't have three lit signs. That's part of the reason that Danielle was talking about having a large scale lettering on the building and basically lighting that. We're close enough to 17 that you'll be able to see that without having to have a separate sign. That's somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000, depending on how nice the masonry is and all that other stuff. So that's a can add up yet to those. Scott, I also noticed that the ditch along Lancaster is pretty minimal and blocked up. Can you talk a little bit about how that's going to feel once this is done? Like, what is your intention with regard to that? There's no curb there. It's kind of doesn't look like very heavy-duty asphalt there.
Right now, we're not including any improvements to the asphalt, the existing asphalt roadway itself as part of this project. We are including
improving the ditch along Lancaster to make sure we can get driveway pipes under. Right now, the ditch is so shallow, you can't really get a pipe to have a good outlet from under those driveways. So we are including making a nicer ditch that will be maintainable. You can mow it, it'll be grass, and it won't be a narrow standing water like
that. How about coming down King Street?
Correct.
That also, right?
Yeah. Okay. Right now, it's just there's a lot of, you know, 8-inch standing water puddles because the ditch isn't done right.
Exactly.
Any other questions about any of that? Otherwise, we've got a slide or two about schedule. Yeah. So we're moving right ahead with this timeline. I think the main thing with being able to, we're going to leave this meeting and basically submit for the site package, right, Scott?
Yeah, we have a meeting scheduled with Division of Environmental Quality for Thursday afternoon. So we'll submit the erosion control and stormwater. That sounds
that's about
45 days.
Yeah. Yep. 45 days ish for that. So it's tracking right along with where when we expect to have comments back from the authority having jurisdiction, and we're gonna start putting it out to the contractors for bidding.
Are there any questions about the timelines? We do wanna if you know contractors in the area or subcontractors that are going to be looking for work, it's probably important to at least share this this schedule with them, because it's a pretty big job here in the county. It's some nice local work. It's going to help the prices if they have it on their radar, and obviously having folks that don't have to drive a ways to the work makes a big difference. So I think, you know, to the extent that we can, it's going to be worthwhile. We're going to do the same thing on our end.
And be sending this to us electronically, right? So
sure.
That if they want to put this out,
social media. Absolutely.
Will the ROM of the construction folks be using local people for your apartments?
Sure.
And see, we're going to be trying to use them for the airport also, so we'll have lots of work to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the reason that we wanted to see this. He said, we want something that relates to it, that not necessarily just matches, but, you know, we don't want something that's ultra, ultra modern, and this, you know, they're going to be in eyesight of each other.
Okay.
So we want them to match in some kind of way, maybe colors at least or something. You know,
having a good brick, I mean, as long as they don't have to be the exact same
sure,
brick, but kind
sure.
of having, that's why we brought the physical samples today,
mm-hmm.
because we're representing what we feel like we're showing you. Here in person, but if you said, hey, this other project is going to use this sort of exterior palette, that's something that we would want to figure out how we interlink.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but the timeline is very similar, because we talk about, you know, going to contract in February,
right.
And but our build time is a lot less. The build time would get us to about April of 20.
Similar, yeah. I think we start our bidding process in February, but yeah, real similar.
Okay.
Good.
We have a meeting Thursday, so I'll get caught up.
Plenty of work, man. Plenty of work for local folks. That's a good thing.
So, are there any other questions? I think that concludes the presentation.
The action that we're asking
the body is to
authorize your firm to move toward completing the construction documents, submittal of the permit and materials, and get us ready to go to bid.
Yes.
Primarily the exterior materials and where they place on the building, and building mass. I think those are two major and floor plan. We're talking about that.
So moved.
First day.
Second. They're too busy talking.
We made a motion to move forward with the presentation, what we got here, so they can move forward. I think we have a motion and a second.
Yeah.
We'll carry on a conversation by the Senate later. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Here's your
kiss.
And we're going to sleep with Sarah.
The blue that we're showing here would be that blue, unless the one objects to it.
Okay.
I mean,
yeah,
we feel we can't control.
Okay.
Yeah.
we can't control the specific manufacturers because on a public job, we basically have to say if you're one of three and everybody's got a little different on their standard colors. But this is going to be our basis of design.
I mean, the final color selection, we can do that a little bit later on.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're ways off.
We don't want to represent something here that we share with you all and you share further with constituents, and then it's why is that not what we got? That's the main thing. Perfect. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And if anything that we produce is a function of your work, we'd be glad to turn over. So if you have high schoolers or something,
we'll take a 5-minute recess.
The model that we're doing, we'll sketch a model being on the walk-in.
Have a lock key system.
You could do a video class and actually take that and do a video walkthrough using that model
where the road is on.
We've done that for some part.
Okay, first change. Sarah copied my desk calendar. Campbell has changed the date to the 22nd instead of the 29th.
Okay.
They've given us a 2-hour window, 10 a.m. to 12 noon. They primarily want to talk with the hospital folks and some of the faith community folks. Steve has reserved the River Center for that, and that's just kind of open to whoever can make that work for their schedule. But it's 10 to 12 on the 22nd. And I think Sarah was talking with y'all about the essentials of county government. That's Thursday and Friday, the 31st and the 1st.
Oh, and Sheila mentioned February 20th today.
Run over
the partner. We're doing a meeting at the River Center at noon.
Oh, okay.
This came in after I printed it.
Okay, when you're looking at the February calendar, there's another meeting on the 20th, Roanoke River Partners with Cooperative Extension. Do we have time? 12 noon luncheon.
Mm-hmm, 12, yep.
Okay, that's all I know about that. Mm-hmm.
What's the date on
the 20th. The 20th.
20th.
But otherwise, when the board said it's calendar for this 2019 year, you all set the 18th as a work session on a Monday. I'm assuming that's an all day, or at least start at 9 and go to the drop. And then we have the NACO legislative session. We go ahead and pre-book everybody, and then if you don't want to attend, we'll pull out those registrations. But because these conferences always generate a lot of activity, we try to get you all secured with registered in the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So that also falls right in the middle of your March board meeting. So if you'd want to consider kicking that a week forward to the 11th, we could do that and get out notices to folks if that's...
Sorry, no, on the NACO, I mean, I know you always try to do this, but try to get us into the host hotel.
Yes, you're there.
That books up real quick.
Yeah, you're there.
If you don't, it's
yeah,
it's
I think
way
she did
more
those several weeks ago.
Yeah,
so
as soon as
there,
it opens, I'm like...
We're getting better at that. But in terms of your March meeting, if y'all would consider the 11th, then hopefully we'll have that meeting wrapped up before Sarah does that pre-op
that
C-section.
Annual baby thing.
I just see on the 16th, there's going to be something with forestry at 6 o'clock.
That's actually tomorrow night, the 15th.
It's the 15th. That's right. It's the 15th.
What's that? Oh, I don't know.
What is it?
We've got a dinner for landowners with the baby.
My
forefathers
had
some kind of surgery.
That's it.
Surgery?
That.
Yeah. Is he the same one? Is that, I mean,
that's the same one.
Yeah,
it's
Mike Hoggard would be the...
And he's having surgery?
Yeah.
If it's the same
one. It's the same one. It's the same one. Well, you know, I didn't know the agenda for that because I was asking Billy about it today. Because there was a lot of folks calling me and wanted to know if the the flooding and stuff was connected with this meeting? And Billy said, no, it's not.
I don't think so.
No,
he
said
it's not. They sent an agenda to the property.
Landowners, and as a landowner dinner for timber owners,
right,
for them to explain what the Forestry Service can help them with if they need help with this.
Some taxing issues, some land use issues, that kind of stuff. But there's something out here, just if you hear it, about, you know, the rising river waters and that kind of stuff between here and between here and Williamston, and also even on Highway 11.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of folks are concerned about that. They were thinking that this land use is that it's not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody good for that consensus? 11th of March for the commissioner meeting? Yeah. Consensus is?
I'll have to.
All right, you want to get back?
Yeah.
He's good.
Long enough time to move it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's all there's for the commissioner. Tentatively, it's for the 11th of March.
Okay.
Ron's going to look at his calendar, just not going to get back to you.
Sure, sure. Okay.
All right. So, you know, the brief of the review of upcoming meetings?
Yeah.
Okay. Distribution, revised discussion points, plan sessions?
Yeah. Behind your agenda, I've got 3 pages attached where I've trying to update that list I sent out a week ago based on feedback from the commissioners, also highlighting the action that y'all took on the 7th. We've got a very active list of some things the board had in progress, others we're definitely going to need direction on. One of the items that Chairman Trent asked me to include in here is the latest draft of the private road safety access draft ordinance. That's in the pocket behind the agenda. On the right hand side are some of the older items related to the safety ordinance. And the last thing on the left side are some bullet points for public information related to the tall class of water 10-acre acquisition.
Okay.
So I know we got a work session on the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this stuff is current and moving ahead, but the If there's interest in advancing your private road ordinance, whatever we're calling it, we'll need some guidance on the timetable for that. Because I think, Jonathan, does this constitute zoning? It'll need a public hearing for this type of... So we would need probably 30 days to get the proper notice out.
Are we going to move forward with that ordinance?
See,
that's
the thing.
According to this general statute?
We never decide. We debated this thing crazy, but we've never decided, are we moving forward or not, right?
Like y'all tabled it back in February.
We need to make that decision. We need to make that decision. If not...
Well,
okay.
This general statute talks about DOT doing it and not the county. And the DOT paying for it and not the county is what you got highlighted here.
Well, and again, this goes back to 2013, and when we researched it and had, gosh, the gentleman that just retired, Scott
Emery,
he told us that basically there was no money for that, and the state was not a, this is just kind of a historical collection leading up to some of the most recent.
Right, this dates back to 2013, though.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
My understanding was that the pricing thing was, if the owner, once given notice, didn't do it, then we would require them to pay for it via the taxes, assignment, that kind of thing. And that's where we left it.
Yeah.
I don't read in general statute that even general statute gives us that authority.
It does not.
But how do we do that? Well, we don't have the authority to do that.
No. This is an ordinance. It's not a statute. We debated this. If you recall, what we said was, you know, yes, it could be challenged. Absolutely, it could. That doesn't mean it will be, and it doesn't prevent us from passing the ordinance. I mean, if not, exactly. What are we going to do?
I thought we said if we pass it and then you're challenged and you can't do anything, then you're worried. What's the point?
Well, according to Cliff, when I met with him, he's rewritten this ordinance to where he can defend it, and that's what he told me. Is that not correct?
I haven't sat down and talked to him since he rewrote it.
I did, okay. And that was his statement to me.
Let's
I said,
that.
So this is the
let's
defendable
see
ordinance.
That up-to-date ordinance mm-hmm. and talk to Cliff.
It can be. If it's here, the safest ways are the county condemns the road and then spends county funds to bring it up to standards. But then you got to bring it up to DOT standards, so that's not always the best way. Plus, the county's the one fronting the money.
Okay, but the ordinance isn't talking about DOT standards. It has nothing to do with DOT standards.
No. I'm just telling you what some of your options are.
Okay.
I mean, second is a special assessment, but then you got to have at least 75% of the people on the road that agree that you want to do it, and then you assess it to them. So the way to, you know, the only conceivable way to have an ordinance that sets a standard and forces it on people that they have to spend the money, they have to fix it, is to make it just as objective and very clear what the standards are as possible. And I think that's what Cliff has gotten around to saying, is he thinks he's got it to where it's got enough objective standards in it that it's not subjective. It's not.
But that burden of the cost would be on the property owner.
Right.
Not the residents.
Absolutely.
The property owner of the road.
The road,
and
correct.
If they did not do what we required them to do, then we would then force that requirement, if you will, tax-wise or whatever way we do it to enforce it, that they would pay.
We want to read the ordinance real quick so everybody has a clear understanding, has questions as we go forward. Okay. I'm going to read it out loud. That's all right for everybody.
Is this the newest?
This is the newest.
Let's set this out this morning.
This ordinance is entitled the Berthier County Safety Maintenance Ordinance and may be cited as the Safety Maintenance Ordinance. Whereas, in order to promote the health, safety, and general welfare of the citizens of Berthier County, North Carolina, to allow for and provide for safe and timely emergency services to those citizens of Berthier County, and to abate and repair any deterrence to these services because of the conditions of any roadways which have been deemed to be detrimental to the public health, safety, and general welfare of a citizen of this county and said conditions have been determined to be a public nuisance, it is desirable and necessary to adopt the safety and maintenance ordinance for the territorial jurisdiction of Berthier County herein set forth. Jurisdiction. Upon adoption of this ordinance shall govern every private and public road not maintained by the North Carolina Department of Transportation within Berthier County, North Carolina, where said road provides for public or private access to at a minimum one residence or dwelling which is used for residential purposes. Article 2, Section 201 General. For the purpose of this ordinance, certain terms and words are used herein shall be interpreted and set forth herein. 202, Words Interpretation. For the purpose of this ordinance, certain words shall be interpreted as follows. The word may is permissive. The words shall and will are mandatory. The present tense includes the future tense, and future tense includes the present tense. The singular includes the plural, and the plural includes the singular. The word county shall mean Berthier County, North Carolina. The words county commissioners shall mean the Berthier County Board of Commissioners. The word persons include firm, association, organizations, trusts, companies, corporations, or any legal entity, as well as individual. The word used or occupied include the phrases intended to be occupied or used. 203 definition, dwellings. For the purpose of this ordinance, dwellings means any building, structure, manufactured home, or mobile home occupied, maintained, or intended for use as a residence. Enforcement officer. The enforcement officer for Berthier County shall be the Emergency Management Service Director and Sheriff of Berthier County. Each is vested with the powers and authority granted under Article 3 of this ordinance. Private road, a road or street that has not been accepted nor planned or accepted by North Carolina Department of Transportation or other governmental entity and which provides vehicular access to residential areas containing a minimum of two dwellings. A private road shall not include a private driveway providing egress and egress to a single private residence. Owner, the legal owner of the parcel or real property upon which any part of the private road is situated as documented in the Bertie County Tax Office, and owner will only be responsible pursuant to Article 3 of this ordinance for that portion or section of the private road which is found within the boundary of their parcel as defined by the Bertie County Tax and Mapping Department. Residence, a place where a person or group of persons reside on a permanent or temporary basis. Extreme weather conditions. For the purposes of this statute, extreme weather conditions are those meteorological conditions which result in excessive precipitation, including ice, rain, or snow that would make an otherwise passable private road unpassable, or a meteorological condition resulting in damage which causes a private road to not be passable. In the event said road is damaged as a result of said extreme weather, the owner shall have the same time allotted under Article 4, Section 5.1 to repair said damage and bring said road, private road, in compliance with this ordinance. Obstacle, any natural or man-made impediment or debris acting as a hindrance to vehicle travel on a road or street. Vehicles, two- or four-wheel drive vehicles owned and operated by law enforcement, emergency management services, or any fire department which are used in the execution of public services. General provisions. Any private road within the jurisdiction of this ordinance will be subject to the specifications set forth within this article. All private roads must be passable for all vehicles defined under Article 2, Section 203. The private road must be passable. Passable is defined as being clear of obstacles and capable of being traveled upon safely. Travel will be deemed safe when said private roads is devoid of any and all holes, cracks, crevices, potholes, or other breaks in the road which cause the bottom chassis of the vehicle to come in contact with the ground or water during the extreme weather conditions. The deterioration of what constitutes passable will be determined by the enforcement officer based upon the specification contained herein. Exceptions. The specifications set forth in this ordinance do not apply during extreme weather conditions or to situations where a private road becomes unpassable based upon extreme weather conditions. Maintenance. The owner of said private road shall have a specific duty to maintain, repair, and bring up to standard all private roads within the jurisdiction of this ordinance. Any and all private roads subject to this ordinance shall be subject to inspection by enforcement officers to ensure compliance with specifications set forth in Article 3, Section 402 above. Compliance. Any current owner of a private road subject to this ordinance shall have 45 days to come into compliance with said ordinance. All new private road subjects to this ordinance shall be built in compliance with the specifications set forth in Article 3, Section 402 and above. Section 501, General Provisions. If the specifications required by the ordinance are not met within a 45-day period, the owner of said private road shall be guilty of a Class 3 misdemeanor and assessed a $500 fine. Pursuant in North Carolina General Statutes 14-4, in lieu of or in addition to the criminal penalties outlined above, the private road owner may be subject to a civil penalty pursuant to North Carolina General Statutes 153A-123-C of $1,000 per day for each day the violation continues. Recoverable by the county in a civil action in the nature of the debt, in addition to all other remedies available either at law or in equity, as violations of this order is deemed a public nuisance, the county may institute an action in the General Court of Justice, more specifically Superior Court of Bertie County, seeking enforcement of the ordinance by injunction and order of abatement pursuant to North Carolina General Statutes 153A-123. D and E, including but not limited to, action by the county seeking an order of abatement requiring the private road owner to make the necessary improvements to said private road within the time allowed by the court, where upon noncompliance with the abatement order, the county may execute the order making the necessary repairs and maintenance, creating a lien upon the owner's real property for the cost of executing said order.
under jurisdiction section 103, it says at a minimum of one residence or dwelling, which is used, but over under definitions on the private road, it says two dwellings. Is that contradictory?
Yes.
I think that just needs to be changed.
We'll go with two dwellings, is that what you're saying?
That was my, okay. Yes, because it was my understanding that I was expecting the numerous times you talked about this, that, you know, we're really addressing these areas that are roads that are servicing a couple of homes. We're not talking about specifically one driveway. And we've gone through a number of ways, you know, length of driveway, things like that. And frankly, I just thought it was easier to define and easier to enforce if we just made it clear that what we were dealing with was something more than, you know, one driveway to a home.
So we're going with at least two?
Yes. So it'll read more like it'll read like the private road under the definitions. And frankly, I came up with that last night, and I think I just forgot to change it.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so the back here in the back on the 501, the owner's real property. That's not that said path or said road, or that would be his house, his car. That we would go after instead of
that. Well, a car would be personal property.
Right.
I mean, real property just defines any land. Personal property would be that, cars.
Well, we don't want that path.
No, I understand.
We continue to maintain.
Sure. The way I read the statute, the real property means any taxable land within the county becomes a personal property.
Be a personal home.
One other question. What if the landowner does not live in the county? Does that mean he's not important?
The county would only be able to attach the property to an emerging county. So, sure, I mean, if it was someone that owned land in, say, Chilliwack County, we would not be able to attach a lien against that property. But at least
But in that case, though, wouldn't, if he owns that road, to Tammy's question, it would be, that road is taxable in Berkeley.
Yes,
so
that's correct.
That's what we,
correct.
Obviously he has property, okay.
Yes.
If we take that road, then we got to continue. It's a moot point.
Exactly, sure.
I don't know how feasible this would be for the county or for the citizens. Because if they don't do it, then it's $1,000 per day. And if they didn't do it, evidently they didn't have the money. And if you're taxing them $1,000 a day, then you want to put a lien on their real property. I need to think about this. Yeah, till our work session.
And now I would note that that number could be modified by you guys. I mean, it doesn't. No. 1,000 is not a number that's necessarily required by statute. And you know, it's also something that you will see a number of times.
See, what I'm thinking about, I'm just using him as an example, but there are plenty others. But I know him personally, my father. He's 95, and he has the trailer park. Buses and this weather, he has spent this past year over $8,000 to have it. And it's still not where it needs to be, in my opinion, you know. But
you know, some, I've been down that path you're talking about, and that path is passable, okay? We're not.
You've been down Jerry Lane?
I ain't been down that. Yes, I've been down that one. No, I'm not talking about, you're...
I ain't talking about Tony Lane, where
I'm
you go to
Baltimore
his house.
I'm talking about Baltimore Court, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's where I'm talking about. I've been down there. We're not talking about that ruts and this, that, and the other. That's different. We're talking about where vehicles bottom out at.
No, you don't bottom out, but be close.
But you know, my opinion is, we've talked about that. We need to, as a board, decide if we're going to support it or not. Whatever the vote is, that's what the vote is. But we have citizens who hit me every single week who talk about this and what are we going to do. Mm-hmm. So I'd either like to be able to say, well, you took it before the board and the board voted no, or the board voted yes.
Well, I would like to hear what some of the citizens have to say about this. So, in the work session.
Do you think it's defendable? Now, you've drawn up an ordinance, and
to go to fixing these roads, and then we start taking folks to property, and they want to vote the system, so to speak. Is it defendable?
Yes, I think so. I really do. And I'll tell you, I'll give you a comparison that I've dealt with myself lately from the other end of the spectrum, where I was challenging, or I wasn't challenging, but helping someone who had been under an ordinance from another county. And it's the combination of real property that can, and I'm not talking about land combination where you're taking something minor. I'm talking about where it's deemed inhabitable for or uninhabitable for a person to live in. And the state has a general statute that allows the health inspector or the building inspector to come in and condemn businesses when they're deemed that they're not habitable or safe. The statute then allows for counties to adopt that same ordinance for the purposes of residential homes. And that provision is been found to be constitutional numerous times, and it is very, you want to talk about a vague statute, it basically just gives the housing authority, or the director, housing director, and I think sometimes it's in space, it depends on what county's using, it gives that individual a great deal of leeway to determine, and basically all he's got to determine is, in his view, if that piece of property happened, can someone live there safely? And that statute has been upheld. In my opinion, reading that statute from the counties I've seen it in, and even the state statute, this gives them much more specification than that does. So, just using that as a, and that in essence is exactly what this is dealing with. It's a public nuisance, public safety ordinance, and there's been some new law about public nuisance, and that's why they allow you to have this ability to come in and abate, and then fix the property yourself, the county, the ability to do that. The statutes came under this idea of public nuisance when they did that, and it created sort of a new area for general powers. And in my opinion, under the public nuisance and the general health, welfare, safety of your individuals, I think this ordinance stands up.
My question, what would happen in a situation where the landowner is going into foreclosure so he could care less about that land?
Well,
we would be held responsible. Is that right? Or
I mean, there's a couple ways to look at it under the statute. I mean, that's where the same type of abatement issue comes in. Obviously, it would probably be difficult to recover the costs that were put forth by the county. But the reason that the statutes and the state government has allowed and sort of expanded these powers under this public nuisance idea is that, look, they understand that there are times that the county's got to look out for their citizens, even if they're not going to be able to recover from the actual, what I would call, tort fees, or the individual who's done something wrong, and say, look, we've got to look out for our citizens, and maybe it's going to cost us a little bit of taxpayer money, but it's for the betterment of the county as a whole. So that would be the situation right there where, Berthey County would probably have a foot bill for that, but it's up to you.
Okay.
The elected officials to decide whether.
And I ask that because that really happened.
Sure. I can see that.
Or is happening.
Well, Pierce Lane, that gentleman died. His son has it. He has nothing, from what I understand. For us, but that road is one of those roads that is in pretty bad shape. But we don't want that road, so what else are we going to get? And is it fair for my neighbor's tax dollars to pay for them to have that nice record? When that landowner should have taken care of it.
That was not a legal question, huh?
Yeah.
I can't answer that.
You're exactly right. That's all it is.
Yeah. I mean,
you got to do what's right.
Yeah. We have responsibility to the citizens for their safety. I mean, that's how
also,
I see it.
Have responsibility to the other citizens' tax dollars.
Yeah.
Right, but you're putting it on the person who owns the road. You can't assume that they're not going to pay. That's not a fair assumption. They pay their taxes now, right? Or they wouldn't own the land. If they aren't paying their taxes now, they wouldn't own the land.
The only land he owns is that.
But he's paying taxes on it.
That drive that ain't going to pay.
But he's paying taxes on it.
But what he's done is get back there and he's back up and somebody gets in there and can't get back.
My husband was one of them. I get it. I'm looking out for the other 19,000 taxpayers.
There's a lot of circumstances where one citizen benefits from tax dollars more than others.
That's right. That's his nature of beast.
Well, I still need time to think about it, y'all don't mind. And I have an answer on our work session. My vote will be ready.
General consensus, you'd like to the work session?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So we definitely have a work session, come up with an answer, and put it to a vote in the work session, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll make those changes, those small changes there, send out a 25.
Okay.
Who would be responsible for being detrimental to public health, safety, general welfare, or public business?
Under this ordinance, it would be the sheriff or the emergency manager.
It's
who we've listed as the two individuals that made that determination. I think the basis for that is they're the ones who are in control of the emergency vehicles or have the most knowledge of the emergency vehicles that are going to have to be pulling down these paths.
Well, I understand. So this is fine as if the chassis vehicle gets it running?
Yep.
Greg, we had a couple of instances where we could not get to a person who was in serious distress because we couldn't get there.
We had four-wheel drive have to go back because rescues got stuck and the lady passed away inside of the house and we had to back in a four-wheel drive truck to get to the ambulance. We got in the Kelford area fire trucks that can't get back to put fires out. Situations. All right. February 18th, work session. That's one we're going to put it to a vote. Come back. Everybody can read it, have understandings of it, get up from there. Scott, what else we got?
I'd like to request a brief closed session under 11A6 for personnel. So just take a few minutes.
Right. I have a motion.
So moved.
I have a second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. I'd make a motion that we ask the county manager to have a conversation with Dominique Walker about the potential of a position for the county on a full-time basis and determine if she is interested with that and then convey that response and particulars back to the board.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Do we have to post for a job in the county?
Pardon?
Do we have to post for the job?
I think what we can do is we can word it up that it is a continuation of the management fellowship program with us now, because the association only agreed to 12 months for this. But if you're going to assume full funding for this, I think we just continue to call it the management fellowship. And if it evolves into something else, it evolves into something else.
Can we go back to the association and ask if they'll extend?
Well, you can always do that, but at some point we got to fly on our own. But no, I think we can consider this an extension of the fellowship that she's in.
Okay.
But on a permanent basis.
Right. Work session on the 18th of February. Road ordinance is coming back. At that time, we will vote. Okay. After everybody reads it, gets comfortability with it, or no comfortability with it, whatever it may be. Anybody have anything else? Scott, you got anything else?
No, sir.
We clean?
We're all good.
Okay. How about you? You good?
I'm good.
No.
The letter of intent for Golden Leaf. Can we get a copy of that? I think it was due January the 9th.
Yeah, I'll see if I can get a copy of their final version.
Okay.
Wait. I'm just going to ask one question. Scott. The Golden Leaf Project, the Lewis and Woodland Project. Mm-hmm. I sent you a message 10 days ago. Mm-hmm. I want to understand what the county's responsibility is around that project, because when I see letter of intent, I don't know what that means. Letter of intent for what? For the county? For the project?
Actually, the letter of intent is from the town of Lewiston, Woodville.
Okay.
I'm looking
for... So what is the county's responsibility with that?
Well, the county's responsibility was to be the clearinghouse for the grant applications, and I'm looking for my...
Right, when they asked the county manager to determine which ones would go forward, right?
Right.
But
the way this thing...
I've been asked, why haven't we made this public? Why haven't we had this debate about this opportunity in the county? I mean, we write letters of support for a project. I mean, who authorized that?
Well, let me rewind the tape. When this initiative started, the community-based grant initiative for Golden Leaf, Bertie County decided to go after the mobile medical clinic with Biden.
I was there.
And we in fact, on our letter of intent, we mentioned that it was discussed with the board at your planning session on February 12th. A week later, I think it was Chair and
the
Vice Chair and Steve Biggs. We went over to Chowan County and met with the hospital execs and started fleshing out what it might look like. It was mentioned again in the
that was a separate thing that was turned down from the grant opportunity of $1.4 million.
No, this was in the running with the town of Lewiston. The three projects went forward. There was the county's mobile health clinic, there was Lewiston's project, the Vitality Center, and there was the Mideast Commission's, what they call the Workforce Development Advanced Manufacturing Pipeline. Those were the three projects that went forward in September. And the ones that they're most interested, the Golden Lake's most interested in supporting are the ones that create the most jobs. And they didn't see the mobile health clinic as really a job creation initiative. They saw that as providing medical care in a different model. So they asked for revised letters of inquiry from both the Lewiston project and the Mideast project. So there was no other opportunity or advertisement or role for us to... The relationships for these nonprofits are ones that have been, in essence, invited by Golden Leaf to apply.
Oh, wait, Scott. I thought what I read in the message that came to you is that it empowered you, the county manager, to determine which of the ones should go forward, right?
But all the ones that came forward, we just submitted on. I was not.
Yeah, but Scott, but that's not what it said. What do I say to organizations coming in and say, gee, why didn't we know? Why couldn't we submit a proposal or something to be considered?
Well, because they had to start in the planning process with Golden Leaf last January. And that was, I don't know if that was invitation only, but they did their own recruitment of the people and the groups that met with them month after month, because it was both the Golden Leaf Foundation and the Rural Center. It was a joint, and actually the Rural Center kind of took the lead on the development of the local capacity. And
where were we all this time? Where was the board? What was the discussion among us?
The discussion with y'all was in February. Steve Biggs made a report to you all, and that's when we went ahead with the mobile health.
Yes, Scott, but that was the only project that we discussed. I knew nothing. I knew nothing of the Lewis and Woodville project. Zero.
I didn't either until sometime in the summer. I mean, the applications that were submitted to Golden Leaf that were funneled through my office went out September 7th. And I sent the board a copy of everything that anything that hit my desk, I sent it to Golden Leaf.
So how did they know to send it to you?
Because they had been participating in the planning process with Golden Leaf all along. because they had been communicating with Golden Leaf, selected the folks that were in this planning process with the rural center.
Okay, Scott. My understanding was, from talking to the folks I talked to, was that we were asked to submit the projects that we thought had the most, that we the county, was asked to submit the projects that we thought had the most applicable to the project. Not true?
We submitted the projects that were submitted to us. We didn't deny anybody.
Yeah, but
anybody that participated in their process, because Golden Leaf told them, the last step in your application, send this to the county manager. And then the county manager bundled it all up and forwarded it through.
Yeah, I just remember, you know, asking you when the email came out to you, saying, and all of us were copied on it too, not from you, but from others, that said, this is the process, the county manager is going to do this, and the county manager is going to have the authority to decide which of these projects are going to go forward, right? So it seemed like our due diligence would have been able to say to folks who are out here, whether that's Vidant, other app, but some of the people I've been asked for, people at Vidant, or people from Tammy over in your county, place a possibility, saying, I didn't know that this was a possibility. I didn't know that this was available. They didn't know. So, I mean,
we were not set up to be the inviter of the applications or the marketing arm of the rural center and Golden Lake. We were, the county manager's office was brought in as the clearinghouse and the assembler of the application package very late in the game.
The people that did participate, how did they know?
Because they have relationships with Golden Leaf and the Rural Center, and they keep track of those grant applications. And when we were invited to participate, we participated.
I read that email very closely, Scott, when he said there was $1.4 million that could potentially go to Bertie County, and that could be one project up to four projects, and it would be up to the county manager to determine which projects in the county would go forward for consideration to them. Well, if people out there who have projects don't know that it's available to Bertie County, I mean, you didn't have to be connected to Golden Leaf in some other prior process in order to be considered for this. That was not my understanding is that was no requirement. Someone who had never even talked to Golden Leaf, who had a project, could have been considered for this money. Is that not
really
true?
Unfair.
That's really not true. They had a long planning process because they wanted to make sure that projects and communities and applicants really understood what was expected by the Rural Center, what was being made available for
Golden Leaf. How would they have known that? How would these places have known that?
They knew that through their relationships with Golden Leaf.
Was it in the paper?
No. Nothing in the paper. There was one email that the only thing I saw, and I called Scott right afterwards and said, what is this?
There was also a meeting, okay, that Golden Leaf, from my understanding, and I wasn't there, that Steve Biggs was telling me that they had at the Rural Center, okay, and people were at that meeting to get information about these grants that were coming out.
It's been going on for over a year. And
I don't understand. I saw nothing in what was written to you that said that you had to have been in prior discussions with Golden Leaf to be considered for this. No, I saw nothing about that. You know, now people are asking me, well, why didn't we know? Citizens, now why didn't we know? And I don't know what to tell them.
I'd be happy to talk with anybody because
I don't understand why.
The key is really to build those relationships with the Rural Center and the Golden Leaf Foundation.
When Steve Biggs was notified of the meeting, why didn't he notify us?
Can't answer that question.
Because it takes all of us
Steve did. Again, we need to go back.
About the rural center.
But Steve, we write letters of support for a project. Who approved that? This board did not approve any letter of support for a project.
That's for the county.
Scott wrote a letter from the county approving, giving, supporting this project. That never went through us. Right. I didn't know that until I read the letter.
Well, again, I mean, if y'all want to rehash that, I'll get prepared for it. Again, Steve stood before the board. We explained the Rural Center project and the Golden Leaf opportunity that was made available. And Steve went and spent a week and came back and reported to you all, and you all agreed to let him run with the Vidant Mobile Health.
Scott, I was there, but that was not the same scope of project that was $1.4 million. Well, the only project, Scott, wait a minute, the only project that we discussed was the project with Vidant. Nothing else.
Correct.
Nothing else. So my question is, how did the others get into it unless it was conveyed to them? Because Golden Leaf didn't convey it to them. How was it conveyed to them?
I think Golden Leaf did. That's what we're missing here.
All right.
Again, if there's anybody that's got questions, I'd be happy to.
But it's a great project.
Oh, it is. I have no question about it. But there are a lot of other great projects in the county, too. And I think everybody should have been aware of the potential. Anytime this county has the potential to earn $1.4 million, to up to four projects, everybody should be aware of it. Everybody should.
Right, we have a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Yep.
Second. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
I got some fresh fish.